Hello and welcome to the All 80s Movies Podcast, the podcast where we talk about the blockbusters, the flops, and everything in between from one of the freshest decades for movies, the 1980s. I'm your host, Bill Banton. Along with me on this journey back to the 80s is my co-host, Jason Masick. Hello, Jason.
Bill, I guess we're not going to be leaving now, right?
I'm sorry, Jason.
You don't have to be sorry. It wasn't your fault. We better get back because it'll be dark soon. And they mostly come at night. Mostly.
That's right, listeners. Today is part two of our special two-part episode based on that 1986 sci-fi action film Aliens, starring Sigourney Weaver and directed by James Cameron. There was just so much for Jason and I to discuss when talking about Aliens. We had to make this episode a special two-parter.
Hell yeah, man. We could make this into a 10-parter easily. It's good to be back with you, Bill. How are you?
Good.
I'm glad we're still talking about this. And I hope I didn't creep you out too much with that quote to get us started tonight. But I thought, you know, in the spirit of this being kind of a suspense thriller slash horror film, even though James Cameron wouldn't like us to call it a horror film, I thought, you know, let's start off with a little creepiness, right? Me doing an impersonation of Carrie Henn as Newt.
Spot on. Couldn't tell a difference. Mm-hmm. I thought she was in the room with us. Mostly.
Oh, had some fun doing that quote in college.
Yes, we definitely heard that one a lot and many different variations.
That's right. We would improv different versions, like as if we were like James Cameron talking about the film, like saying, this movie is getting awfully costly.
Are
you feeling a little ill, Bill? You look a little ghostly. Ghostly. I don't even know if that makes sense, but too much fun, man. Too much fun. Let's get back into this film, man.
Yeah, let's go for it.
I still had some leftover initial comments from our first podcast, part one. And I just wanted to get through those real quick, cover those if you're okay with that.
Go for it, Jason.
Absolutely. Well, thanks, Bill. Let's just start with the very beginning, man. The title sequence. I don't think we talked about this in part one. This film establishes the tone from the get. You kind of hear James Horner's score with a combination. Maybe it's either that or the wind. And it's just starkness and darkness from the beginning. And the way that the title slowly appears as the credits are rolling and we're getting the top billed cast, I just have an appreciation for it, man. You know, they don't do this anymore with films. And it also harkens back to the original film, Alien, where I adore that opening credit sequence, where the way the actual letters appear on the screen, where it's just pieces of the letter, if you can recall. Oh, yeah. And here, the color blue has a heavy influence on this film. And that's kind of how the lettering appears in this blue, like light that's shining through. It's like backlit by blue. And I don't know. I appreciate the titles every time it comes out. It gives me chills a little bit. I'm like, here we go. Here we go. We're going into a dark universe, and it just sets the tone immediately. Now, as I believe you did, I rewatched the entire film a second time because this is the director's cut. So I wanted to get a feel for the film with all the additional scenes added in to see how it came off, if it felt any different for whatever reason. But I just wanted to talk about the pacing of the first 45 to minutes to an hour. I remember talking about in the first pod how the aliens don't even appear until about the hour mark. And I still have such an appreciation for the pacing of this film, man. It takes its time and it's a slow burn in the beginning. And it just again builds this dread almost. I'm trying to find the right word, but it's because obviously there's a darkness to this movie and you just get a sense of the stakes are building and building before you even see an alien and you know something bad is coming. It's coming and there's nothing you can do to stop it. And the fear just starts to creep in. And I adore the pacing. And I think the pacing is just really smart in the first hour of this film. So I just wanted to mention that. I also wanted to bring up the xenomorph design. I just don't know if I gave Stan Winston and or H.R. Giger enough credit because the design of this particular creature is truly iconic It is one of one. And the design is impeccable. The concept is impeccable. So much rides on it. The way that it's shot, especially in this film in Aliens, the way that James Cameron shoots the aliens, a credit to all of the stunt performers in the costumes, all the different camera angles they use to shoot these aliens, and the camera tricks that they used. But I mean, it's the main character, although the antagonist in the film, it is the main character. Everything relies upon the creature design and the creature effects. If that doesn't work, the movie falls apart. And a credit to what they did in 79 with the original, and then, of course, this in 86. It's just one of the coolest things. I mean, this is what gets my imagination going, because you look at this creature and it's fascinating. I want to know where it came from, how it evolved, and why it does what it does, just simply by looking at the aesthetics of the creature and its design. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because that's one of the amazing things, too, because watching it the second time, I was really just trying to watch the aliens' movements. Mm-hmm. And there may be, and you're really looking for it once or twice, where you almost feel like it's a person in the suit.
Right.
But for the most part,
I agree.
You really feel this is a xenomorph from another planet.
Correct.
They're amazing. So, yeah, definitely credit to the people that are in their suits. They were fabulous. And just some of the stuff, I don't know how they did some of that stuff in the suit, especially the way they just uncurl and unfold.
Yep.
And it's so fluid and graceful. Yeah, it's amazing. They must have been like acrobats or something.
Oh, they were. They were dancers mainly. Yeah. There is a great documentary just called Making of Aliens on YouTube. You can find it and watch it. The suits that they wore are detailed and incredible looking. Obviously, they shoot with a lot of dark colors, and the suits themselves were very stark in color, so you don't see the flaws. However, again, credit to the performers, a lot of dancers. And in the original Alien, they used a 7-foot actor in the suit. And in Aliens, there was a lot of 6-foot tall performers able to get the performance a little bit more, because they were acrobats and dancers and a little bit more agile, and not taking anything away from the 7-foot actor from Alien. But, and then they also used 8-foot models. They actually constructed aliens that did not have actors within them, but they were pliable. They could be molded and moved into positions that humans could not actually contort themselves into. And they could set them up and shoot them from different angles. Like you can see in the behind the scenes, the making of the Alien, Making of Aliens documentary, they set one up to be run over by the APC, which is a great sequence in that initial action sequence. And it's just, it's cool. It's the coolest shit, man. It's just the coolest. But that creature design, again, is just truly inspired. I can't get enough. Stan Winston, famous for Terminator, for the effects on Aliens, Predator. Predator is another one. Or it's just, how did somebody put this together? And these guys are geniuses, because it stays with you and it stayed with me. And H.R. Giger, man, that guy's mind. I don't know how it works, but if you're a fan of his work, you go back to his most famous, I believe, book is The Necronomicon. And if you look through that, you'll get lost and it'll take you to a dark place. But it's fascinating. This guy's art is fascinating. So check it out. If you're at Vroman's, or if you're at you walk down that sci-fi aisle at the bookstore, get lost in a little bit. Don't get too lost. So, yeah, I think also rewatching it today, Bill, here's other random comments here. The Sulaco, I didn't realize this until before, for some reason, I guess it was always in the back of my mind, but the Sulaco design itself, the actual ship, it looks like a giant gun. It's a giant gun with multiple bayonets sticking out of the front of it, which is totally appropriate for a military frigate.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just one giant gun floating through space. I was just like, this is the most obvious thing ever, but it totally works. Again, Also, we were just saying xenomorph over and over again. Had you even heard the term xenomorph before this film was released?
Probably not.
I'd never even heard of it. I'm going to get into that a little bit later, break that down. I was like, what is a xenomorph? Is that because it's actually not the name of the alien? Gorman just says xenomorph to generally describe an alien species, something that is unknown. Also, to give a shout out to the moment when Bishop is getting inside that pipe shaft because he's got to crawl to the colony terminal to patch in and remote pilot the second dropship. Great sequence. It's one of the most claustrophobic sequences ever because I always put myself in his shoes. I'm like, fuck no, I would never do that. Or could I do it? And he has the great line before that saying, you know, I may be synthetic, but I'm not stupid, when he volunteers to actually do that. And a moment that gets glossed over, never really mentioned, I wanted to give a shout out to this moment when Vasquez hands him a pistol right before he gets into the shaft. Yeah. And he looks at it like, what the fuck do I need this for? And he just hands it right to Ripley and she takes it because she understands.
She almost puts her hand up before and like, yeah, just give it. I know you're not taking it.
Right.
That is a good moment.
I love that moment. This is the most important comment I have. And this will be my final initial comment. Are you ready? Are you ready? Brace yourself.
Okay.
One of my favorite things about this film is that the character Private Crow was played by an actor named Tip Tipping. That's it. That's all I got. Tip Tipping.
Which one was Crow? I don't even know which one Crow was.
Okay. So I'm glad you brought that up, Bill, because I mentioned this in part one, how I would get obsessive about trying to figure out everybody's name, who they were, where they were, because, you know, I'm like, I got to know all their names. I got to know everything about this movie. I'm obsessed with the movie. And I was watching Zia going, God damn it. Who's Crow? Where's Crow? And you see it kind of like in the background from time to time. But here's what I believe is when you see Frost, who has all the ammunition in his bag.
Right.
He gets, unfortunately, lit up and he flips over the railing and falls like three floors and he's on fire.
Yes.
Bro is the one that looks over the railing. And then I believe Hicks tries to pull him away, saying, we got to go. We got to go.
Before the ammo blows.
And then the ammo blows and you see somebody go flying. And that's Crow. He's the one that gets killed as a result of that, of Frost exploding.
Yeah, I couldn't point out Crow or Baskey.
There's the other one.
Because I know Baskey? Who's Baskey?
Like, wait, because I did the same thing. Because I was like, wait a minute, was that Crow or is that Wrzbowski? And then that guy gets, Frost explodes, that guy goes flying back and he's dead. And then you hear Hicks going, we've got men down, Wrzbowski, Wrzbowski, let's go. And I'm like, okay, Wrzbowski or whatever, he's still alive. So that must have been Crow that just died. So I'm putting it together. But regardless, the point being here, Bill, let's not get away from the point being that the actor's name is Tipping. Are you kidding me? I love it.
It's Wrzbowski.
Wrzbowski? Wrzbowski.
Yeah. So where's Wrzbowski? Oh my
God. Where's Wrzbowski?
God, that's a tongue twister right there. Oh, I was just enlightened though, because the whole time I'm thinking Hicks is saying Wrzbowski, where he's just basically just saying Wrzbowski.
He's saying his name. You thought he was saying where's Bowski.
Exactly. Like, where's
Bowski? That's his full name is Wrzbowski. Wrzbowski. Oh. He's just.
Leaving. How many times have you seen this? And the whole time I'm thinking, where's Bowski? And it's Wrzbowski.
Where's Waldo? Damn.
Look at that. I learned something my own podcast. Awesome.
You should start like your own, a total spinoff podcast called Where's Bowski?
Yes.
That is just about the Alien franchise. That's fantastic. Where's Bowski? Damn it. Everybody else is like, who's Bowski? Hicks, are you talking about Wrzbowski? They get all confused.
I'm right here.
What's next, Bill?
All right, let's move on to facts and trivia. Facts and trivia about aliens.
Yeah.
All right, Jason. You got anything left? You want to go first?
Yeah, absolutely. Sure. I said I was going to talk about the xenomorph, Bill, and I'm going to do it right here. So the alien xenomorph is actually said to be an endoparasitoid. That's what the alien actually is, an endoparasitoid. So other than H.R. Giger's original design for the xenomorph, parasitoid wasps are said to have actually inspired the creation of the xenomorph alien. They play important roles in regulating the populations of their insect hosts and have been used to regulate agricultural crops to control caterpillar pests. So these wasps will actually lay eggs in other insects.
Oh.
And then the eggs hatch, killing that insect, giving birth to more wasps. It's gross. Now, the difference here is, though, with our endoparasitoids, our xenomorphs, those actually, they're not impregnating their hosts with eggs, as we know. They're more known as a cancer that feeds off the cells of the host, thus taking on some of the qualities and traits of the host. As we know in the franchise, some aliens, if it's birthed from a dog, will take on the traits of that dog versus other creatures that it would come out of. So there's a little bit on the xenomorph and what the actual xenomorph was based on. So that's what I'm going to start with. Also, I'm going to go into this a little bit. The knife trick scene was originally going to be done by Bishop alone, but Lance Henriksen suggested to Cameron to have Hudson's hand put on top of his, to which, but I think it was the reverse, right? It's Bishop puts his hand on top of.
Yeah, he puts his hand on top. Yeah.
Right. So that change was discussed with almost everyone except for Bill Paxton. And I guess, according to Henriksen, he remembers a long night of drinking after shooting this scene, followed by a reshoot of this scene. So because I guess originally it looked too fake when they sped the footage up, so they reshot it. And he accidentally caught Paxton's pinky with the knife on the reshoot.
Whoops.
Oops-a-daisy, which is funny because in the film, actually, he's caught his own. He nicked his own finger, and that's why you see the white blood coming out, basically. But in the actual reshoot, he nicked Bill Paxton. What do you got for some fun facts and trivia, Bill?
So we know James Cameron is the director and writer on this film. So how did he get this project? So when James Cameron was set to film The Terminator, there ended up being a 9-month delay for filming because Arnold Schwarzenegger was contractually obligated to star in Conan the Destroyer. As you know, Arnold wasn't that big yet. He hadn't made The Terminator, so he was kind of stuck with the studio system. So while waiting to begin filming, Cameron was given the opportunity to write a draft for Aliens from a producer with Fox, because Fox finally decided, hey, maybe we should do a sequel to this film. And he only finished 90 pages of the draft before the Terminator filming began. But the studio loved the script so much, they decided to wait for Cameron to finish filming the Terminator with the stipulation that if the Terminator did well, they would give him an opportunity to direct after he finished the script.
There you go.
And luckily, The Terminator was a box office smash in 84, and Cameron got to finish writing and direct Aliens.
It's pretty awesome that they allowed him to do that.
Yeah, that's not something the
that,
studio...
That would never happen today.
No way. They just see cash and like, all right, we'll just get somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting origin of how this all came about. Mm-hmm. But Cameron did, yeah. He wrote it. I was also going to mention Al Matthews, who plays the Marine Sergeant Al Apone in this film.
Love him.
Yeah, great. Sergeant Apone. Apone! He was, in real life, the first Black Marine to be promoted to the rank of sergeant in the field during service in Vietnam. How about that? Al Matthews, real-life hero, badass.
Yes. He definitely seemed like someone I would want to serve under.
Like, oh, yeah.
He was tough, but there was just something about him, like, if he asks me to do something, I'm doing it. He's got my back.
Very charismatic, and you can see it again in the documentary, the behind the scenes. He talks about, obviously, his experience as a Marine, but he was talking about handling the firearms on set and how some of the actors mistakenly would put their fingers on the trigger, which he knows from his training is a major no-no. And he would actually walk up to any actor that put their finger on the trigger and say, if you do that, I'm going to take your weapon and shove it down your throat. He said that on the set to the actors, and that got them to go take their finger off, just because you don't keep it on the trigger. Because even though those weapons weren't loaded, they did have blanks, and the blanks are dangerous.
Yes, they are.
So that's what he would do. He would just kick people's asses. Here's a little bit of a fun fact and trivia too, a little behind the scenes regarding Al Matthews, is the actual APC in the film, that vehicle was a towing vehicle for 747s, which weighed something like something obnoxious, like
75 tons.
Right. And they had to shave it down and they managed to get something like 32 to 35 tons off of it. Mm-hmm. So it was just this hulk of metal. And while they were shooting, the damn roof caved in. And I guess it grazed Sigourney Weaver. Could have killed somebody if it landed on somebody's head. But it was a grave situation. And when that happened, the story goes that Al Matthews just jumped into action. His training kicks in and he was just barking orders left and right, telling people what to do. And the scene was chaotic. It was hectic, but he took control. And luckily, nobody was seriously harmed. And I guess he was quite impressive under that stressful situation. So,
yes,
a lot of credit to Al Matthews. Rest in peace, my friend. Yeah, yep. Passed in 2018.
So Fox actually had an issue with Sigourney Weaver's salary demand for the film and asked James Cameron if he would rewrite the script without her character. Cameron balked at the idea.
Yeah, yeah.
And Weaver ended up getting her payday.
Deservedly so.
Yes.
Well earned.
She probably was underpaid now that you think about it.
Oh, no doubt about it. Here's a fun one for you, Bill Bant. The Alien Nest set was kept intact after filming. It was later used as the Axis Chemicals set for Batman in 1989. When the Batman crew first entered the set, they found most of the Alien Nest was still intact.
Wow.
How cool is that? Can you imagine coming to set one day and walking around going, this looks like weird. This kind of looks familiar. This doesn't feel like the set we're going to be shooting on today, but I guess it is. It looks like Alien a little bit. Oh, yeah, it is. Oh, yeah. It's Alien.
Probably 3 years later.
Yeah.
So about that set. So the interior of the atmospheric processing plant was filmed at a defunct coal generating power plant. And the plant had issues with rust and asbestos that needed to be dealt with before filming began. So they had to do air readings, had to be taken multiple times a day just for safety precautions. But they found out that the air quality in the plant ended up being better than that at Pinewood Studios.
So oh my God.
They did some impressive asbestos removal at this coal plant.
Wow. Got to get some hazard pay out of that, man.
Yeah. So the crew of Batman should be happy about that. That saved them a lot of work and some money.
Yeah, no kidding. So speaking of the sets, and I think I alluded to this in part one, there was a lot of animosity on the set. The British crew was openly hostile to both Cameron and Gail Ann Hurd, producer, because in their eyes, that being the British crew, Cameron was a nobody who had not made a decent film yet. They hadn't seen Terminator. And they mocked Hurd, I guess, because they claimed she only got to be a producer because she was married to Cameron. So there you go. And they wouldn't take orders from a woman. Lovely. Cameron and Hurd, in turn, despised the crew's lazy, insolent, and arrogant behavior. There were some problems. A little tension there on set.
Yeah, and that was interesting to me because in the documentary I saw, yeah, there was a lot of back and forth between Cameron and the crew. And I was always like, well, why do they have this crew? And I didn't know at Pinewood, the crew comes with the studio. So you pretty much get stuck with this crew.
Yeah.
So I think there was something I saw when Cameron had left saying, I'm never coming back here again, but you guys will Correct. Be stuck here for the rest of your lives or something
right.
like that.
I'd read that as well. It's a great quote. And he stuck to it.
Yeah.
He never went back to Pinewood. Another little fun fact, the alien screams are baboon shrieks that are altered in post-production.
Yeah, when I read that, I was like, you know what? Yeah, I definitely could see that. There's definitely a baboon-like quality to it.
I wasn't aware of this, but Sigourney Weaver was very open about the fact that she hated guns. She hates guns. And it was a real turnoff for her to come onto set. Even though she had read the script, you know, she came onto set and she didn't realize how the weaponry played such an important part in the film and how they were just the weapons and the guns, especially were just ever present. Mm-hmm. And so that was something she just had to cope with and got adjusted to, but it was something she had to deal with.
That's true. Cause when you think of her filmography, yeah, she really doesn't That's really the only thing. I can't think of anything else where she really uses guns. No, she was in that movie. She was a cop or something, or FBI profiler.
Serial killer
with
Copycat.
Copycat.
Yep.
Does she have a gun in that? I don't know.
I don't know. That's a good question.
And then I even looking at the other Alien films, does she really have a weapon?
Now that I'm trying to think of Alien 3, Alien Resurrection, she probably didn't. I think the point was in Resurrection, she's a bit of a hybrid. So
right, exactly.
She's just a badass. She doesn't even need a gun. Interesting. Yeah. Now looking at her filmography, that'd be something to look at.
Yeah.
And pay attention to now knowing that she's has a sensitivity. Very anti-gun. Here's an interesting story. So Hicks, as we just now know and love the, I mean, we're fans of Michael Biehn. I'm in the Michael Biehn hive. I'm all about it. But Hicks was originally played by James Remar.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. I just had not known that. And Michael Biehn replaced him only a few days after principal photography began. And they said originally that was due to artistic differences between Remar and Cameron. But I guess in a podcast called Sidebar, Remar actually states, he's open about it, states that he was fired from the production because he was busted for possession of drugs. He said it was a period of his life when he developed a terrible drug problem. And Remar still appears in the finished film. He's seen for one shot when the Marines enter the alien nest. Because he's seen from behind, he's wearing the same armor as Michael Biehn. It's impossible to tell the difference between the two actors.
So, yeah, it's funny because Michael Biehn's one complaint by taking over the role was all the actors got to dress up their armor. So that all the slogans they have on there or the pictures they have
right.
was all done by the actors.
Their own. Sure.
But Michael Biehn had to wear what James Remar had, and he hated the fact.
For continuity, of course.
Yeah, yeah, he hated the fact on his chest plate, there's a giant red heart because Michael Biehn felt like it looks like a giant target. It's in the middle of my chest. I don't want to have this.
Right.
But he had to keep it.
Oh, man.
But that was the only issue he had about having to take on the role. But he was very excited that he got offered the part.
That's good stuff. Yeah, I think he found out like on a Friday night and then had to be on set like that Monday.
Yep.
And there's a very parallel story that happened with John Hurt in the original. Mm-hmm. Because he was not originally cast as Kane. And it was like a quick, he had to step in and over like a matter of just a couple of days.
Yeah. And there was another interesting thing about the casting too, was most of the Marine Corps crew came in 2 weeks early to do training. Mm. And so they all got to know each other and bond. But because of Sigourney's schedule, she couldn't get there until 3 days before filming. Paul Reiser couldn't get there until 2 days before filming. And even the actor who played Gorman, William Hope, he also had a scheduling conflict. So he came in late. So in a way that actually almost worked for the film itself because the three of them are kind of like a separate group.
Oh, sure.
So yeah, so it almost kind of fit in a way how they all were together and bonded. And then even in the film, you see that opening scene where there's the four of them are sitting alone by themselves.
Oh, yeah. It's already cliquish. Yeah. Yeah.
So that almost kind of even happened accidentally before the filming even started, where they came in together, trained, bonded, and then the rest of the actors came in, felt a little isolated because they came in later.
That's funny. You know, there's another story that I read, and this will be my last bit of fun facts and trivia, was that to really capture the bond between the Colonial Marines, they actually, one of the shots of them all together when they're just kind of shooting the shit, that was one of the final shots that they got. They didn't shoot that until the end of the shoot. So all the actors had spent however many days, months shooting together. They had already formed a natural bond throughout the shoot. So it made sense to then shoot that scene of them, which chronologically takes place earlier in the film, but now their bond has already been established off screen, if that makes sense. So that on screen, it seems like, yeah, these guys and girls have spent a lot of time together. Thought that was smart.
All right. So for my last fun fact and trivia, I know we mentioned the first podcast that Jason and I had not seen this movie when it initially came out in theaters, but we did get to see it together later on. So back in 2016 on Aliens Day, which is April 26th because of LV-426. We went to a screening of Aliens presented by the Alamo Draft House, And afterwards, they had a Q&A with Carrie Henn, Jeanette Goldstein, and Rico Ross, who played Frost. Pretty sure there's someone else, but I cannot for the life of me remember who it was. But the cool thing was, so the big takeaway I had from that Q&A was, so for Carrie Henn, this was the only film role that she did. She didn't do anything after this.
Right. Yep.
And so she is now a elementary school teacher out here somewhere in California. And she was saying how every once in a while, one of her students will show up to class with a copy of Aliens and will ask her to sign it for her dad or mom, whatever.
Right.
And she gets surprised sometimes, too, when the students actually tell her, like, oh, yeah, I watched this, because she feels like, you know, you're a little too young to be watching this movie, even though sure. she played a role in it.
That's cool. So that still happens today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she said the other thing was, like, sometimes she would get really antsy on set when they had that set of the chute that Newt ends up sliding down when she gets separated from
right. Hicks. One of the ducks when she slides out of the flight jacket.
So they kept that on set. So that would be like her reward for good days. Like, you can go play on the slide, because she loved going down that slide.
Sure.
So she was like, some days she would just spend all day just jumping down the chute.
That's funny. That's great. Got to keep the kids happy.
Yep. So that's our facts and trivia for Aliens. And I'm sure we could literally do 10-part podcast on just facts and trivia.
Yeah, you can just go onto IMDb. I mean, it's well documented. There's story upon story, which is really cool. It's great. There's plenty of information, behind the scenes info on this film.
Yeah, tons of documentaries, tons of things you can find on YouTube.
Yeah.
So if you're a big fan, just go check it out. We literally touched on the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, and I would do yourself a favor and watch The Making of Aliens on YouTube. Good documentary, yeah.
All right, so moving on to soundtrack.
Yes, sir.
And track for Aliens was done by James Horner.
Ever heard of him?
Yeah, maybe. And this was his first collaboration with James Cameron, who would also go on to do the music for some movie about a boat.
I know the movie you're talking about. I do.
Think it did. Okay.
Yeah, I have that in my list of the films. Yeah, that he scored. That's Titanic.
Yes, Titanic. That's
right. Titanic.
Yes. Yeah.
I actually had to sound it out. I did the enunciation here with the hyphens in between Titanic. Titanic. Yes. Titanic. Yeah. I guess that was a big movie and that did well at the box office. So good for him, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad the two of them got to work again.
So.
Yes, Jason. I know you're excited to talk about the music from.
Oh, yeah. I mean, always, my friend. And thanks for, you know, introducing this segment. This is the OST, the official soundtrack segment. When I was growing up, Bill Bant, I'd like to say that I was a fan of the three J's: John Williams, Jerry Goldsmith, and James Horner. And I couldn't escape them because all of my favorite films were scored by these three gentlemen. And this in particular was James Horner working on Aliens. You know, immediately I'd mentioned this earlier in this pod, how the film, you hear the score and it's haunting. It's haunting. The drum line throughout, the echoing horns. Now, James Horner has a very identifiable signature. And sometimes it's like three or four notes with the horns. It's the progression of the strings, and especially the steel drums can allow us, whether it be 48 hours. Bill, I was listening to the score from Red Heat today, and I was getting flashbacks. I had that on cassette. I'd listen to it all the time. That's a weird score, but there's some good stuff in there. It's a mixture of steel drums, synth, horns, guitar, saxophone. It's all over the place, and we won't get into the film itself, but I still love that score.
I'm surprised they even released that.
Oh, yeah, sure. And then, you know, doing the scores for the Tom Clancy films, when you get Patriot Games, Clear and Present Danger, films like that, his stuff is extremely identifiable. Good. You know, you can have your opinion on it. I like it, but I'll hear that with the horns and I'm like, oh yeah, that's James Horner. And you hear it in all of his scores. It's not like sometimes I'm like, wow, he's not even trying to be different. And I don't care. I don't give a shit. It still sounds great. Like the steel drums, 48 hours, like very identifiable, like great soundtrack. You're like, this is urban jungle, like jungle type soundtrack, and it works and it's different. And then Commando comes around, which he did score for. It's the same soundtrack. It's literally the same score, like some of the music cues. And it's like, oh, all right. Again, not really trying to be different. It works for this too. Let's go with it. Let's roll with it. I'm a James Horner fan. On this particular production, like you said, first time working with James Cameron, it was a fucking nightmare. Let's just say it how it was. He thought he was going to have at least 6 weeks to compose this. It ended up being closer to 3 weeks, maybe even shorter than that. The problem was when he arrived to work with the orchestra and do the composing, the film was still being shot. It hadn't been finished.
Right.
That was a real problem. And it went into editing. And he was going back and forth with Cameron. Cameron wasn't a fan of the stuff he was coming up with. And they had issues, which they obviously resolved later on because they would go on to work on much bigger projects. Obviously, I was joking with Titanic, but Titanic. Anyway, they got over it. And I was going to say, regardless, I've listened to the soundtrack, Bill, to death on cassette forever. Funny enough, the score versus the music that's actually used in the film are two completely different things. The music in the film is an amalgamation edit of different music cues. It's not the tracks from the original soundtrack score. So if you are to look up, let's say on YouTube Music, the original score, it has the tracks, the listing, the titles. Those tracks in their entirety are not used in the film. There's like bits and pieces that are edited together from those tracks. The only track entitled Bishop's Countdown is the one that's used in its entirety. And that I believe has that famous, that crescendo, that march when you have Bishop's Countdown, when he's rescues Ripley and Newt aboard the dropship, and then they take off and they escape the explosion at the end. And then it's used, that same music, that drum, the building drum, is used when the alien queen is basically jettisoned out of the loading dock, the airlock at the end. It's a great, great song, but the music is all over the place. And I think this was nominated for best score too, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. So, and again, only the music in the beginning of the film Aliens and at the ending of the film is actually used where James Horner had planned it to be used. Cameron took the score that Horner had composed and just chopped it up and put it in the places where he thought it was more appropriate. It wasn't as much up to Horner, thus a lot of the issues. Okay, so to wrap up this segment, many of us are very aware that the music used at the very end of a little film called Die Hard, when our beloved Al shoots the evil terrorist Carl, that end of Die Hard, that is music that was recorded for Aliens. That music was never actually used in the film Aliens. That music is actually from a track from the score. It's called Resolution in Hyperspace. So what ended up happening was John McTiernan used that music that James Horner had recorded originally as a temp track for Die Hard, for that sequence at the end of Die Hard. But he liked it so much, he left it in. And in my humble opinion, it works well. It's identifiable because I was such a fan that when I saw the end of Die Hard, I'm like, oh my God, they're ripping off Aliens. They're using the Aliens music. But they technically weren't. That music cue was not used in the film Aliens. It was just on the soundtrack.
That's awesome.
Although it works for that final sequence in Die Hard, it is a departure from the otherwise brilliant score by Michael Kamen.
Yep.
And it is a little bit off-putting if you're a fan of film music when that James Horner piece of music, that music cue comes in at the end of Die Hard. You're like, wait a minute, this isn't the music from the movie.
Right.
Because it's very different from the Michael Kamen score, in my opinion. But love James Horner. And if I had to pick like my favorite score, it's really tough. But I probably would have to go with Star Trek II. The Wrath of Khan is just, it's awesome.
Yes. All right. So moving on to our next segment is the Swiss cheese or complaint department.
Yeah.
Why do we call this Swiss cheese, Jason?
We call this Swiss cheese because although this movie is delicious, it does have holes.
I will go first on this. And this is a little part Swiss cheese and a little complaint. So, because in the movie, they lose communication with LV-426 and they're going to go out there, find out what the hell's going on.
Correct.
And you have this huge, huge spaceship, the Sulaco.
All correct.
Yes. So they are traveling to LV-426 with 15 crew members. Shouldn't they have more people on the ship?
It's a great point. You know, I that was lurking in the back of my mind when I saw the Sulaco crawling across the screen again today, going, this is a giant military frigate. Yeah, you would think, who's driving the ship, first of all?
That's one for every 10 people that are on the planet. We find out there's 158 people on LV-426. Like, say there was some kind of plague down there. Who's going to take care of them? They only had one medical to take care of 158 people?
Yeah.
Or bishops, so maybe two.
Oh, I see what you're saying. If the colonists were found in good health or whatever, or maybe they were just injured or whatever. Yeah, they weren't quite properly manned to handle that many people.
Exactly.
That many colonists. Oh, yeah, they're way undermanned. Like, yeah, what would they do if they had found them alive and well, or just ill?
Yeah, they were just ill or something. And then
great point. Weird, yeah, too, I never really thought about that.
Yeah, and then everyone leaves the ship to go down to LV-426. There's no one on the ship. The ship is, the Sulaco is up there in orbit by itself.
Right, right. They're really relying heavily on the computer system, guidance system, probably to take over, you know, the autopilot. We'll just put it on autopilot. You know, it's the future, everything. It'll be fine.
Say a meteor strikes the ship and now they're abandoned there. They have nowhere to go. I always just thought that was weird. I'm like, why did you need that big of a ship to go out to if you were only going to have a tiny crew? And then everyone just leaves the ship to go down on the planet. That made no sense to me.
I love it. I think that's hilarious. I think it's great. It's a great point. As I compare everything to Star Wars, I think of like the Star Destroyers, or you think of any sci-fi film where there's a huge military vehicle floating through space. Immediately, my mind will go to, I can't imagine how many crew members are aboard that ship. Like a Star Destroyer may carry, I don't know, thousands of crew members. I think it's 2,000 or something like that. Or probably more. I don't know. Somebody tweet us, tell us. So yes, yeah, somebody's got to be driving the ship. All it takes, and they do it in Star Wars, they do it in numerous films, it's just a handful of extras in the background walking around doing
exactly
menial tasks or whatever. Or you show the bridge of the ship and just somebody hitting some controls. You don't even need to have, they don't have to have lines. They don't have to speak, whatever. It's just an establishing shot that, oh, there's a crew on this ship operating the ship. And we have a military team that's about to embark on a mission. But two really good points.
I understand for the sake of the story, you have to do this. But did Ripley even have to leave the Sulaco? If she was an advisor, right, she would have done all the advising from up there. And then maybe there was a reason for her to come down and further
to verify something in person, maybe.
Exactly.
But you're right. Yeah, just via video, she should.
Or after the Marine Corps gets their asses kicked, then she would have to fly down and save them or something like that. But yeah, I always just thought it was weird. I was like, that's it. That's all they're sending is 15 people to check on this colony. That just seems odd to me.
I love it. Great points. They should have had more colonial Marines and more people on the ship itself.
Or someone from the company. I don't know. Something.
Yeah, but you know what? You bring up a really good point too, though. I was thinking they make it a point to have Ripley say, you don't need me. I don't need to go with you, before she actually goes on the mission with them, which is smart. But then they kind of convince her, of course, to go, like, we need your expertise. You're the only one that had an actual encounter with a xenomorph, et cetera. And she's having the nightmares and she decides, well, she has to go. But you're right. If you really want to get nitpicky, she does not need to be on the ground. She doesn't have to have boots on the ground.
No.
Nope. But then we wouldn't have a movie.
Bill. No, exactly. That's what I said. You have to do it.
So here, I'm gonna get my one hole out of the way.
Go ahead.
I'm just going to give you my one hole, Bill. here we go. Once they're inside the colony, speaking of boots on the ground, we have our colonial Marines have landed. They get off on the APC and they get into what we now know as the Hadley's Hope colony. We kind of touched on this. Well, we did touch on this in part one, Bill. There would be human blood everywhere. There just would be.
Yeah, I think there's only one shot that I saw that might have been blood, but you couldn't tell.
Because I understand it gives more to the mystery of it and a bit of an eeriness of it, the fact that everyone's vanished, right? Absolutely. Love it. But I'm sorry. We know too much. The aliens are violent creatures. And if they have an inner tongue that thrusts and punches holes in people's heads, there's going to be blood.
Yeah.
And they're not just kidnapping all the colonists. Many of them are being murdered by these aliens. There's got to be traces of blood.
Yeah.
So I think that's a hole for me. It always has been in the back of my mind. They're smart with the fact that we can tell the colonists have tried to barricade things. There's been explosions from seismic charges. There's signs of small arms gunfire, etc., but no blood at all. I mean, even the aliens bled, right? Bled acid. There's holes, but there's no human blood. Doesn't make sense.
Unless they have like a cleaning crew that goes back there and the aliens
are like a robot.
It's a little dustpan and brush. Right.
You see the little Roombas going?
Yeah.
They're still operational. The aliens didn't take those
just
out.
Just does traces of DNA and just cleans it all off.
That's great.
But yeah, speaking of the aliens blood, because that was another issue I had too, is that the acid for blood isn't very consistent throughout the movie.
Hmm.
Because the one scene I was thinking of is when they have the last stand and Newt decides to take them through the tunnels and Vasquez is blowing those aliens up. I'm like, wouldn't the acid just dissolve the tunnel?
Oh, sure.
And then the aliens would have nowhere to go. And then, you know, it was always convenient where some of the Marines would shoot an alien and then the acid would flail on them. But other times, I mean, especially in that beginning thing, the way they're jumping around, they're shooting them over their head. I'm like,
and be raining acid
all over the place. So
it's a great, I've thought about that too, especially, yeah, watching that initial action sequence when they're in that alien nest. There's exploding alien heads left and right and bodies. I agree with you. Totally. Somebody who gets, everybody gets splashed.
Yeah. And even at the end, when Ripley and Newt are in the hive and she's blowing up all the eggs and things are just blowing up, I'm like, you got debris and you got acid everywhere. And they get out of that totally.
Completely. That's funny. Watching that final sequence too, I was like, she single-handedly kills like five drone aliens. But I was going, there's only five?
Right.
Wouldn't there be 100 hanging out?
Oh, yeah.
Guarding the queen and all of the eggs? I mean, regardless, in the opening sequence and every other action sequence, there's a million aliens coming after them. You see it on the motion tracker. But when Ripley and Newt are facing off with the queen at the very end, there's only five hanging out.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know. Are all their other
the logic fails searching? There. Yeah.
Maybe they were trying to fix the atmosphere pressure. Maybe they realized there's a rupture too. I'm like, oh my God, we got to fix this. That'd be great. You just see them like clank, clank, clank.
Right. They're trying to fix all the holes that the other aliens have. They're like, damn it. Does acid for blood seemed like a good idea? It's too much work. It's too much work.
Oh,
that's hilarious. But that's, you know what? That's really all I had for holes, because I think Cameron is a smart director and a smart storyteller. I don't find a lot of other plot holes, to be honest. I think the plot's pretty sound otherwise. That's just my opinion, man. Maybe I didn't look hard enough. Did you have any other holes, man?
I just had the one for the complaint department, a continuity error, which I don't know if I've ever seen this before. Maybe I haven't. I just forgot about it. Is Ripley's headset when the Marines are going down to the processor and all hell breaks loose.
Right.
So there's a scene where you find out Apon dies and she yells, "He's gone." And she doesn't have her headset on. And then literally the next line It cuts away and then goes back to her. And she's like, get them out of there. And then the headset's back on.
Oh,
yeah. And then she loses it. I was like, oh, that's a big one. Because I mean, wow. you got something on your head and then it's missing and then it's back again. So I thought that was kind of fun. I was like, wait, have I seen that before? Why have I not seen that or read about that before? But yeah, watch Ripley's headset during that scene. I think she
gotcha.
Did it once or twice.
You know, that just makes me think of too, with the comms, because I always get confused as to who can hear who and when you're talking into the mic, when you have one of those headsets on, because they talk to each other. You know, Gorman's talking to Apone, Apone's talking to Hicks and Hudson and everybody else. And sometimes they seem to be able to hear each other, and then sometimes they don't. Is it is the mic always on, or are they kind of like, are they turning it on and off? Is it voice activated? I don't understand how that works.
That's true, because there was the one where Gorman sounds like he's trying to talk directly to Apom about, you know, what their strategy is moving back. I'm like, yeah, everyone should hear that.
Thank you very much. That's a perfect example, because when Ripley's telling him, hey, they can't be firing underneath the heating, whatever thing with the cooling situation, it's going to explode. And he's like, shit. And I'm like, wait, he's talking right into the mic when he's talking to Ripley too. Can everybody hear everybody all the time? I get confused with the communications a little bit. What it reminds me of, funny enough, is Apollo 13, which doesn't come out until years later, but obviously based on a true story. When Tom Hanks, they call it Vox on the thing, when they can turn their mic on and off. And sometimes they forget that it's still on. And so when they're talking candidly, they don't realize Houston can hear everything they're saying. So they could be saying, oh, they're fucking things up down there. And they're like, Commander Lovell, by the way, you're still on Vox. He's like, oh shit. He's gonna turn it off. That's what it makes me think of. Like, because a lot of them are talking candidly, you know, making fun of each other or whatever. I'm like, wait a minute, you're talking into the mic, man. Can't they hear you? Or am I not seeing there's a switch of some kind, or maybe you have to, I don't know how those things are activated.
Yeah, because that actually makes me think of another scene is when the Marines first go down there to processing plant to find the colonists, and they decide like, oh, they got the wrong weapons. It's like, why did they explain to them why they couldn't use the pulse rifles? Because I'm like, wouldn't that make more sense for them to understand why they should not use them?
Oh, instead of just telling him to pack up all the ammo and don't fire,
or
just making a blanket instead of actually explaining why they can't use their weapons,
or just turn around. You got to come back and get the flamethrowers or something else.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah. Yeah. You just explain to your guys, tell them you're putting your life in danger if you fire a weapon down there.
Like if they were further in and they found one of the colonists, no, you don't have them step away at that point because, you know, you got to see what's going on, but they hadn't gotten there yet. So it's like, why don't you just
tell them
to turn around?
Yeah. Yeah. We got to rethink this.
Right. Pistols and whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Frost says, what are we supposed to use? Harsh language? He's totally right.
Oh, completely. It's ridiculous. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good point. Here's a little one for you.
Oh, you got another one?
I'm going to file some issues with the complaints department. You can keep poking holes, man.
No, I got it.
Okay.
I'm good.
Here's a really small one, but I just thought it was funny. I was just laughing to myself. I was thinking, man, they should have put Ripley in a better room on the Gateway International Space Station, basically. We see Gorman and Burke walking down the dark hallway to go talk to her, to tell her that they've lost communication with the colony. And they're walking down this like hallway. There's trash on the floor. And I'm like, oh man, she's like in the slums on this Gateway station. She's like in the ghetto. And I'm like, guys, Gateway custodial crew, you guys got to clean it up. Clean it up. Where's the Roomba there?
Yeah, you would think in the future. So yeah, that actually sparks two questions. My first one is, how much time do you think passed before they go to Ripley to say, hey, we lost contact with LV-426?
Mm-hmm.
Because we know she's been going to psych vals, her evaluations, because for some reason Burke has access to them. So he can
read,
which what happened to Dr. Patient Privilege? Like, why does Burke get to read these? I'm sure someone needs to read them for the company, but why Burke? And then when you said, yeah, she was still in the station, I was kind of like, is she still in the station? No, I guess so. I don't think she ever does go to Earth.
Oh, I got you. I see. You thought maybe like, right. Yeah. No, I think she's still on the station.
Yeah, it does make sense the way they talk about the story. But yeah, for station, it does have a little shitty area like that. That is kind of sucky.
Yeah, I just thought that was funny. Like they made it a little bit trashy. You just think it'd be cleaner. It was just interesting. There's trash on the ground.
No, I agree with that too.
That's like a production design or set design, choice. Uh-huh. Somebody made that choice to put trash in the hallway. I was like, I wonder what the motivation behind that was,
Yeah, in a little rinky-dink room. But I just wanted to know how much time passed between her talking to the company about what happened and getting decommissioned to now running to her and saying, hey, we lost contact. I'm like, couple weeks, couple months.
I just assumed it wasn't much time because
we established she has a job and she's been working.
Oh, that's true. That's a great point. Yeah. Good point, Bill. So it has been a little bit of time.
Yeah, because it almost feels like it happens the next day. But then I'm like, no.
But no, there had to have been some passage of time. Maybe a lot. Because we know then later on that Burke is the one that sent the colonists to go investigate the alien ship on LV-426.
Right.
And he did so based on the report that Ripley had given.
Yes. Okay. I wanted to confirm that. I wasn't 100% sure.
Because they weren't privy to that information until they retrieved her. So it couldn't have been that long between the investigation, gathering that information that she had given her report. And then based on that information, he instructs the colonists to go investigate the ship. So it must have been probably a couple weeks or something like that.
We'll cover this in the next section.
Good stuff. Good stuff.
Is there anything else?
Oh, yeah. I got stuff, man.
I always got stuff. I got stuff.
I think here's something interesting. Speaking of that, the inquest by that court of inquiry.
I like that. Inquest.
I know, right? I like that word. Ripley has written out a report, and they make reference to the report as in this unknown creature that has acid for blood. And she's like, yeah, that's what I wrote. And I think it's interesting that Ripley talks to the people around the conference table, but then also once she's on the Sulaco and she's talking to the Colonial Marines and she's doing, Gorman says, Ripley, why don't you tell them what they're up against here? And she says, well, this is kind of what happened. One of these things latched itself to the face of one of my crew members and sort of gestated with it. And I'm going, she never actually tells or describes the alien itself to anyone to prepare them. She just describes some things in vague generalities, but never actually describes the alien to anybody, which I think is just like the first thing you would do, as in saying like, well, it was approximately 8 feet tall. It was bipedal, had like the serrated spiny tail, like spindly features, elongated curved skull. It has an exoskeleton, doesn't really have eyes, sharp teeth, and inner mouth that thrusts out at such a velocity, it would put a hole through your fucking face and out the back of your goddamn head.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you say that? Something along those lines in describing to somebody what they might be encountering?
Yeah, I agree with you too, because I never liked that first speech when she talks to the crew about what they're dealing with, because I felt like, they don't need to know that part. They need to know what's probably down there, not the facehuggers, but the actual aliens themselves. No, that's a great point.
She's been face to face. The whole end of the first film is her face to face with an actual fully grown alien creature, a xenomorph, an endoparasitoid in the flesh. I'm like, isn't it just traditional like police work? We're like, do a sketch. Where's the police sketch? Like, can you draw it for us? Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, just describe. This is kind of what you're going to be looking for. This is what it looks like.
Yeah, because then maybe when they go down into the hive.
Yeah,
exactly. They might have a better chance. I mean, they were so well blended in anyway. I don't think they
Oh, right. She doesn't know. That's basically almost like that's in their backyard.
Yeah.
They're in their element. So she wouldn't know anything about that. Not from the first film. Not from her previous experiences, but she knows what it looks like.
Then they would have an idea.
That's exactly what she's talking about. That's it. Yeah. That's the alien. That's what we're supposed to be looking for. Or at least they'd know what to look for. You know what I mean? They'd just kind of be knowing what to look for.
Yeah, they seemed to, they were more focused on the facehuggers than the actual aliens.
Right, themselves. Yeah. Which is obviously to be feared. You know, that's something, but it just seemed odd to me. Like, just tell them what the damn alien looks like.
I love it. It's so funny. I had so little notes for Swiss cheese in the plate department. Now we're just totally hating on this.
I know. Now we're just, this is the worst fucking movie I've ever seen. God.
What other you have to talk about?
So after that initial, it's a bullshit movie. Fucking James Cameron's idiot.
Yeah.
After the initial confrontation with the aliens in that nest, Hudson notices that Dietrich and Apone are still alive. Like, wait, their signals are faint, but they're still alive. They're still alive. Ripley specifically says they can't go back for them because they're being cocooned.
Yes.
And then she's the one that risks the whole fucking mission at the end to go back for Newt later.
It's a kid.
I'm totally kidding. I'm just saying, I just think it's interesting that she specifically tells Hudson, you can't go back for these people because they're being cocooned, when that's exactly what she does at the end of the film. You know, I mean, come on. I'll bring it up again later on. It's like after Hudson goes down, he's not dead. No. Go back for Hudson. I'm going to bring that up later, actually, in a question I have for you. So
all right.
That was an issue I had.
I was thinking about that, too. I'm like, I wonder if the end, when they were getting attacked by that last, if it was the APOM alien, if it was the Rosbowski alien that was coming after them.
As in, Chestburster had already gestated at one of the Colonia Marines and grew into a full grown alien and was attacking it. Why not? That would be weird, right? If Ripley recognized one of the aliens as one of the Marines.
Yeah.
That alien's moving a little bit like Drake. I can see in his swagger.
Yeah. Yeah. Or Dietrich or one of those.
Or tipping.
Yeah.
Hey, man, is Newt a little cheesy? Has she always been a little cheesy?
Oh, man.
I know. No?
No.
Don't feel bad for saying it. You don't think so?
No. All right. Give me an example. Why do you think she's cheesy?
Affirmative. The thumbs up, the salute, just kind of, it's not.
You don't like the thumbs up? I love the thumbs up. I don't understand. Okay. I don't understand why they put her in the APC to begin with. Keep her back with Bishop.
Good point. Okay. All right. If Newt works for you, more power to you. That's great. I always had a little difficulty. You know, this gets cleared up, I think, in the director's cut, actually. I always had a little difficulty knowing exactly where they were. Just mean general location for, you know, the colony complex, operations, med lab versus the actual atmosphere processor and its sublevels. I would get a little disoriented as to what, who's where, what's going on. That was kind of an issue I've always had.
I agree with that.
It's not ultimately distracting. Like, it doesn't upset me. It was just a little bit of a nagging issue in the back of my mind. I was like, not quite sure where they are. Mm-hmm. In the theatrical cut, when they're trying to figure out where to barricade and weld the door shut in this corridor, I get lost every time. I'm like, I don't know what they're talking about.
Oh, yeah.
I get that they have to cut off the corridor that leads from the atmosphere processor to the actual colony complex to Hadley's Hope. Mm-hmm. But then they're talking about doors and got sealed off here and here. And I don't know if you're meant to know exactly, because they're just kind of pointing at a blueprint in random spots.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's a little disorienting.
It might add to the atmosphere of the film where you're just, you know, you have no idea what's going on. It's all chaos.
Bill, that's fine. Just disagree with me on all my issues. You know, that's fine. No, it's all right. Hey, you know, we don't have to agree on everything. Hey, man, how much fucking ammo did they have? Hicks takes stock of it, right? He says, we've got 4 M41A pulse rifles. They got about 50 rounds each. Right. That ain't great. He literally says, that's not great.
Correct.
Or that's not good, or whatever he says. And then later on, when they're backed up into the operations center there and the aliens come through the ceiling, they are blasting away.
Yeah, they should have ran out of ammo by the time they got to the
door. I get to be a stickler now with the ammo issue. If you're going to give us the whole counter thing, which is a great device in the film, and you're going to tell us exactly how much ammo you do have, then we're going to be counting. I'm going to be paying attention. And I think Vasquez in particular, she shoots a lot. When the aliens fall through the ceiling and then they get backed up and then into the vents and she's still firing.
Yeah, she shouldn't
have. She switches over to the grenade launcher, but then she goes back to just shooting regular rounds. And I'm like, no, she's spent way more than 50 rounds.
Exactly.
I get it. You know, that's a stupid nitpick thing. But hey, if you're going to tell us how much you got, then
use it.
What else you got? What else you got, Bill Bant?
No, that was all I had.
Oh, okay.
I'm good.
Hey, do you think, man, Newt sliding out of that jacket to fall down that her favorite slide?
I'll give you that one.
I have an issue with that every time. I'm like, no, you don't need to. She's not sliding out of that jacket.
No,
she's fine. Don't she like she had to work to get out of that jacket.
Yes. Even if she was just sliding out of the jacket, grab the jacket.
Yes. Right. Yeah. 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 You just don't go, oh, no, I'm helpless. You know, flailing around helpless. that doesn't quite work for me.
I actually thought of another complaint now. All right. Since we're going.
Let's do it.
All right. So at the end, when Ripley gets up on the platform and Bishop's not there with the ship and they're standing on the platform and we're hearing everything fall, collapse, crumble, and the fact that neither of them get hit by any
debris
whatsoever.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. And no. But no. They'd be electrocuted by something or they'd explode or be burnt to a crisp or the platform disintegrates below them or the queen just comes out of y'all. I don't know why the queen pauses. Why does the queen's hanging out in the elevator for a few seconds, like taking a dramatic pause.
Like just run out and grab.
Yeah.
This was funny because I might have said this last podcast, because I didn't think the queen could fit in the elevator.
Oh, yeah.
And the queen could not fit in the elevator.
Correct. Had a little fun fact behind the scenes trivia right there. They did. Yeah,
they had to take
her tail off.
Yes. So I was glad to find out I was kind of right on that.
Yeah. Her ass was sticking out of the damn elevator and they had to put like black over it. So when you look at that shot, you can see she's surrounded in black because she's basically sticking out of the back of the damn thing.
Yep.
That's funny. All right. So I think this is going to be my last issue. I'm going to file with the complaints department.
Got it.
Very, very final action sequence. Ripley fighting the queen. Opening the loading dock doors, opening that airlock is extremely fucking reckless.
Yes.
Not a good move by Ripley.
No.
It's exciting as hell, and it worked for me as a kid, but I'm watching it now, and I'm like, you just put Newt at risk. You protecting Newt this entire time. Like, that's your purpose. You found purpose in that. And here, I just try to reach down with one hand and untie your shoe before opening the damn airlock so that the alien will yank your shoe off and fly out into space. Because when she opens it, all hell breaks loose. Like, everybody's going to die.
Yes.
Everybody will die. You have debris flying around. There's little cargo boxes that almost nail her. Newt almost goes flying into the thing, except for half-bodied Bishop saves her at the last second. He should be flying through the... Everybody should be dead.
Yeah. Yeah, that bothers me too, because A, why does she have to climb out in order to close it? I'm like, if you can open the door there, why can't you close the door there? And there's no way she could hang on with all that air rushing out. She should have flew out too. And then every time she climbs up to the top and that one box comes flying,
yeah, I'm talking about.
I'm always expected to hit her. Just one time, I just want to see it hit her and knock her out. Yeah.
See, again, very exciting, but just like, wow, you just put everybody at risk by doing that.
Yeah.
Which is like, what's the point then if everybody dies? But that would, I wonder if that was the original ending. Everybody just gets sucked out.
Damn it. See, now this brings another complaint. Because
here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, we were going to talk about the director's cut, but instead we're going to tell you why this movie sucks. Our favorite movie of all time.
Okay. So technically she kills the queen by sucking her out into space.
Right.
But the queen gets on the ship somehow by latching itself onto the drop ship. And doesn't the drop ship leave the atmosphere to get to the ship? So isn't there... Does the queen hold her breath that long before she gets on the ship? that she's okay?
Well, that's a very good point.
Can aliens survive?
Can aliens breathe in space? Yeah. Because you're right. And to be honest, we do see the queen. She's still screaming. So apparently.
That's true.
You can hear someone scream in space.
Yes. She blows the whole premise of the first film.
God damn it. Wow. We just unraveled this whole thing. So yeah, it's funny though, because you don't necessarily see the queen like freeze. Like we always see like human beings. Like
yeah.
If you're exposed to outer space, your blood, your everything, you just instantly freeze. Apparently, yeah, maybe the alien doesn't necessarily die in outer space. I don't know. It's a question that we won't get answered anytime soon, I have a feeling.
Damn it.
All right. Let's regroup, man. Let's regroup. That was tough.
Okay.
That was tough for aliens.
Yeah, I don't know if we can publish this episode now because everyone's like, wow, I didn't realize how much this movie sucked. Oh, we're going to get hate mail. I know it. So let us move on to the director's cut.
Yeah.
And we're going to do a little segment called Keep It or Cut It. So the special edition of Aliens was released a couple of years later, and it has a running time of 2 hours and 34 minutes. So that means 17 minutes of extra footage. Mm-hmm. So Jason and I are going to quickly go through the, we're not going to go quickly through the scenes, but we're going to go through the scenes. Yeah. We're going to go through the scenes and decide if they made the right move by cutting it, or we think they should have kept it.
Got it.
So the first big scene in the special edition is we find out that Ripley had a daughter. And there's a scene when she's up on the station and she's waiting to do the inquest. And Burke comes in to get her all ready to talk about what happened to the Nostromo. And Ripley asks Burke if she has any information on her daughter.
Right.
And at that point, Burke tells her the bad news that they did find her. And unfortunately, she died 2 years ago at the age of 66. And she was cremated. And they show a picture of the daughter. And of course, Ripley is very emotional. And she just gets that bad news right before she goes into the inquest. So that is the first big scene that they put into the special edition. I will ask you this, Jason. Do you think they should have kept it or did the right thing by cutting it?
This is a tough one, man, because the motherhood theme throughout the film is very present. I'm going to bring this up repeatedly, probably throughout, is how important do you feel it is to the film? Because depending on that, I believe whether or not the scene should be kept or cut. Honestly, I'm going to say keep it. I actually like the scene. I forgot about this one. When it happened, I was like, have I even watched the director's cut? I'm going, what is happening right now? It's like, wait, she had a, oh yeah, this makes sense because then her attachment to Newt is enhanced for me. And I didn't feel that this scene was too drawn out either. It was well acted because it starts off with Ripley sitting on a bench and it appears as if she's like in a peaceful surrounding. She's at a park, but we understand that it's just a screen of it, like a park setting with trees and grass and birds chirping. And it's very peaceful. And that makes sense because she's trying to find some peace at this point. I actually liked this scene. I thought it was kind of bittersweet. And it makes you think because she's been asleep for 57 years. She missed her daughter's entire life and death. And she sees a picture of her daughter as an elderly woman. And it just kind of messes with your head a little bit. But then I think, again, it just enhances what's to come between, you know, her relationship to Newt, if that makes sense. So that's my take on it. I keep it.
I'm with you. I would have kept it. I probably would have changed the picture. Because I'm like, come on, is that in the future? And it looks like a screenshot from a video cam from a convenience store.
Right. Not a great quality photo, which a little behind the scenes info, that actually is Sigourney Weaver's mother.
Yeah. And then why do they use a picture of her when she's in her 60s? Why don't they show, like, if you were to show a picture of her family.
It's a little brutal.
Like, if you were to show me a picture of your family, would you show your most recent picture? Or would you show a picture maybe in their prime, per se?
That's a good question. I think if they had passed, yeah, I would probably choose a more flattering photo.
Yeah.
A little more complimentary photo. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought I liked this again. I thought it was bittersweet because that it makes you think, because it there's an emotional attachment to Ripley then here, but she's going through something here. It's traumatic. She wants to know what's happened to her daughter. Her daughter has passed away. Her daughter is 30 years older than she is at this point. So it messes with your head because of the timing. And then she tells that brief story about how the last time she had talked to her daughter named Amy, that she told her she'd be home for her 11th birthday, but she never came home because she had gone on the mission.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's sad. It's a sad scene.
Yeah. All right. So we both agreed to keep it. So the next thing, it's very, very brief. So it is in the middle of the inquest. They took out a couple of lines where the company pretty much gives what their verdict is on the findings. And they decide that Ripley has her ICC license suspended, so she can no longer be on part of a flight crew. It's maybe three or four extra lines.
Right. Van Leeuwen does most of the talking. Yeah.
Yeah.
The head of the council or whatever, the inquest. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they make the decision right there and tell her what's going to happen.
You're unfit to hold an ICC license as a commercial flight officer. No criminal charges will be filed, but you have to submit to psychiatric testing or whatever. Yeah.
Right. So keep it or cut it.
Cut it. Not necessary. This is my opinion. It doesn't affect the story one way or another. The fact that she no longer holds a license as a flight officer doesn't bear any weight on the story for me personally. Maybe the fact that she's been demoted, as you've said earlier, I understand that that would have an effect on you probably, or that they didn't believe her story, so to speak, and that she's actually being punished for her actions, which she was in, you know, totally in the right. It didn't, it's just not necessary. It's minor. It's just very minor for me. How about you?
I'd actually keep it.
Okay.
I could see why they cut it out, but
yeah,
I'd keep it.
All right.
All right. So the next one is a pretty big scene.
It is. Yeah. This is a chunk.
Yeah. So this is our first look at the Hadley Hope, population 158. So we actually get to see the colony before the devastation. And it's broken into basically two scenes. And the first scene is basically two of the colonists talk about how they get this information for the company, that they want to send someone out to go check this area. And they're like, why the hell do they want to do this? And they're in communication with this group that has gone out to this designated spot on LV-426 to investigate. And if they find something, get a claim. And they're like, yeah, sure, whatever. You know, we barely get to talk to the company as it is. But according to me, if they find something out there, they can get the claim for it. And
right.
Then at that point, you see that there's kids running around and playing in restricted areas. And
there's a kid on a big wheel.
Yes.
That's awesome.
Pedaling around, kind of like The Shining. But yeah, you see the colonists there. It's an active colony and things are moving and shaking.
Right.
So then we cut to basically a rover that's on the planet's surface, and we see it's Newt and her family. So Newt, her brother Timmy, who just happened to be played by Carrie Ann's real life brother, Christopher Henn.
Right.
So there's some good casting there. So I thought they played brother sister real well. And then her parents, and they come across the ship. So the ship that we see from the first film from Alien. And they're all excited that, ooh, this is going to be big for us. We found something. And Newt's parents decide they're going to go in and check out the ship. And they go in. And you can kind of tell there's a passage of time because Timmy's asleep. Newt's kind of longingly look out the window, wonder what's going on. And she wakes up Timmy. She's like, they've been gone there. You know, they've been gone a long time. What are we going to do? And then right away, door comes flying open. The mom goes in, grabs the radio and starts calling for help.
Yeah.
And Newt looks over her shoulder to see what's going on. And you see the dad lying on the ground with the face hugger.
Oof. Rough. And you get the Newt scream.
Yes. The first of the Newt screams.
It's a chunk. That's a big scene. And my first thought immediately when I was watching it was like, oh, wow, they probably spent a lot of money on this scene to have then cut it out for the theatrical release. That must have been a gut punch.
Yes.
That was my thought. I was like, ooh, that had to hurt. That had to hurt cutting this out because that's a lot. But I want to hear your opinion on it first. Keep it or cut it.
I go back and forth all the time because I think I like the fact that you don't see anything until the Marines get there and you just see the devastation. So in the back of your mind, it's like, ooh, what happened before? I would love to know. So here it is, and I love it, but in a way it affects the rest of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then we meet Newt. I think maybe if it wasn't Newt in the scene, I would keep
it. Okay, sure. Yeah.
But the fact that we see it's Newt, because then we run across her later.
Right. I think it is meant, obviously, in part to set her character up. Yeah.
I'm going to cut it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. All right.
It's not a hard cut. That's a...
Speaking of hard cuts, I love the smash cut at the end of it when it goes straight from her scream to then absolute quiet of Ripley with the cigarette dangling between her fingers and the long ash.
Oh, yeah.
It goes from, it's a really hard cut. I love it because mm-hmm. it's such an intense moment with her father lying on the ground with a face hugger attached to him and she's screaming and it just goes and it cuts right to Ripley.
Yes. And I love they still have cigarettes even then.
In the future. Yeah. Smoking away.
Yeah. We think they'd invent something better by then, but.
So, yeah, they should have all been vaping.
Mm-hmm.
Not that that's a whole lot better, actually, as it turns out. But so here's my opinion. I would 100% absolutely cut it.
Okay. So you got to.
I would leave this on the cutting room floor. I thought it was the right call for the theatrical release. It's a pacing issue for me. As I mentioned earlier, I'm setting myself up for this discussion, is that the first hour of this film, I think, is so brilliantly paced. And a large part of it is that Ripley is our avatar, basically, as the audience. We are kind of watching the story unfold as Ripley from her point of view, so to speak. We're watching her story unfold. So when it cuts away from her story to go to LV-426, it's a little bit jarring for me. And it feels like it's too soon. We don't need to see this yet. We're building, building, building. And I love the pacing and the theatrical release because we don't see the planet yet. We're aware of it. We're aware of the threat. We're aware of the danger and the stakes because of Ripley and Sigourney Weaver's performance and how she's trying to explain it to the inquest, how she's explaining it to the Colonial Marines. And the Marines don't know what they're up against. And then when we arrive on the planet, we see the devastation, but the crew, the colonists have vanished and we don't know what happened. And it's completely mysterious. It's extremely eerie. And I think all of that gets dissipated if you have this scene. Like all of that, that's taken away the level of mystery and eeriness. Also, that feeling of what happened here. When you arrive on a scene and you're just, all you have is questions. What the hell happened here? You know, and all of that mystery goes out the window. You're revealing too much too soon, in my opinion, by putting this scene in here. I understand why it's there. I understand the setup, but it's more effective in the genre of a thriller, the way it's paced in the original theatrical release without this scene being there in the beginning. This is the type of scene that works great right now, like for a DVD release, for a little side story. Like if you're going to watch a little, you know, they did it with Prometheus and maybe Alien Covenant as well, where they had like David had little side stories that were on that they released before the movie came out. It's mm-hmm. not in the actual film, but gives you some sort of background on what's happening. So I thought it ultimately disrupts the pacing of the setup of the film. There's some cool stuff. Hey, don't get me wrong. I want to see that alien ship as much. I think the design of that ship is cool. But, you know, they step onto the ship. We don't get to see much of the interior. We don't see what happens there. Again, I just liked it better the original way, where it's just a slow burn until they finally get there. And then they have to put the pieces together. And we are going along the ride as if we were one of them, either Ripley or one of the Colonial Marines going on the mission, trying to figure out what happened to these colonists. And that is kind of ruined by the information, you know, the scene here. That's kind of an artistic take. That's it.
Yeah. And there's definitely novelizations. And I know I have a copy of the Dark Horse comics called Newt's Tale, which tells the story of aliens from her perspective. And it even gets into the aliens' attack of the colonist. And it's crazy because in the comics, she actually sees her brother get taken by the aliens as she jumps into the air vent to get away.
Yeah.
You could read about the stuff somewhere else. There's one of the books I think does a deep dive of actually the parents going into the ship and with the experience and how all that went down. So, yeah. So we're in agreement. Got it.
Yep. Yep.
I like it, but yeah, I don't think you really need it.
It just belongs somewhere else in my
opinion. It's a little too much away. Like you like to see it, but you don't want to see it.
Yeah. All right. What's the next one?
All right, so the next one is when we first see the Sulaco going out to LV-426. It's just a series of additional shots of the interior of the ship, kind of the layout of it, before it actually gets to everyone in the cryo sleep tubes.
Yep.
I would just say cut it. They revisit these same sets again anyway. I don't really need to see them in the dark or the fact that there's no one there.
Yeah.
So I'm okay with cutting it.
I totally understand that. And I'm going to disagree. I'd keep this 100%, but this is totally an artistic choice. It's also an homage to the entire sequence that happens in Alien when we see shots of the quiet Nostromo ship before they awake. And you just get a sense of place. I love that shit. And when the camera moves across the weapon room, we see all the rifles in place and hold, and then it moves out into the actual docking area, and we see the two drop ships, and there's that shot with the chains are just slightly swinging, and it's just so quiet, and you just hear those chains. And that, again, I think is actually an homage to the Nostromo from Alien. That's just my take on it, where it's kind of like, it's just fucking eerie because they're all asleep. And the ship is in the middle of space, and you as an audience member now are on board this ship, and nobody else is awake, is setting the tone. It gives me a certain feeling that I like from an artistic point of view, but that's just me, my opinion, my sensibility, and my wheelhouse kind of thing. So I'd keep it. That's just my take on it.
All right. So our next one is Hudson's ultimate badass speech. So there's a scene when they're on the drop ship about to head down to LV-426 and everyone's strapped in. And I think the ship is released at this point, right? Or is it right before it releases?
I think it's been released. I think it is dropping through. Okay. I think, yeah.
And Hudson is up talking to Ripley, explaining you have nothing to worry about. You're with a bunch of ultimate badasses.
Right.
And then he basically goes through the inventory of the weapons that they have that are going to take out these xenomorphs that they come across. It's a funny scene, but I would cut it because I almost think in a way it contradicts Hudson's character because you kind of see, like, I know it's like almost in a little way a comic relief, but I think the thing we loved about Hudson is he seems like he's such a pussy.
Hmm. Except I see where you're going
down,
with it.
Down. Like, I almost feel like it gives a hint that he's a little bit tougher than we think he is. And I think it wouldn't make that last scene as effective. So I would cut it.
Well, I would totally cut it as well. I mean, I'm total agreement. It's not necessary. It's fun because we get to see Bill Paxton do a little bit of his improv. He's been known to say that a lot of his lines were improv. This feels like this was improv. Yeah, I understand what you're saying, though. It doesn't seem totally in line with his character from what we know, how he performs later on. But also, it's not necessary, but it is, I was just thinking in my mind, it is while they're dropping through space and through the atmosphere, because immediately afterward you see Apone does his somebody wake up Hicks, because they're about to land. So I think that does all happen mid-air. But there is one little moment in there, because when he's going through the inventory and naming off the weapons, like, we're here to protect you. We've got this, that, the other thing. We got these rifles. He says, he mentions a phased plasma pulse rifle. And I thought that has to be a nod to a very particular scene in Terminator with Schwarzenegger when he goes into the pawn shop, when he goes into the gun shop.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Because he actually specifically says, you know, I'll take the pistol with the laser sighting. And then he asks, I'll take a phased plasma rifle in a 40 watt range.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, only what you see, pal. That's such a great scene in Terminator. So I thought Cameron had to put in that, because Hudson says, he goes through, we've got the M41A, we got this, that, and the other, we got the phased plasma pulse rifle. And I'm like, oh, that's got to be a nod to the Terminator.
Gotcha.
I could be wrong, but I thought, hey, maybe I caught something there in that little additional scene. But yeah, I cut it, put it on the floor.
All right. So the next one is the motion tracker false alarm. So the Marines have gotten on LV-426. They're doing their initial sweep. They're not finding anything. They're about halfway through, and then all of a sudden, one of the motion trackers goes off.
Yep.
And you're like, ooh, here we go. About to meet our first alien. And they end up tracking it down to a room, and I think it's Drake goes to bust in, and we just find out it's basically a hamster cage, and they're tracking hamsters running around in their little habitat.
Right. Yeah, I think it's Hudson. Hudson kicks the door in.
Oh, okay.
And sees the mice in the, or the, yeah, you're right, the whatever, the hamsters in the cage, yeah.
Cut it or keep it?
I cut it. It kind of creates a little bit of tension. It's the first time that the motion tracker is going off. It's supposed to be a little bit of a tense moment, a moment of suspense, a little scare, possibly. It's one of those take it or leave it kind of thing. It just doesn't do it for me. I'd cut it. You know, we get enough motion tracker usage to develop that tension later on. That's a lot more effective than this scene.
Yeah. Now I feel bad they just left those poor guys there. All right. So the next scene, I call this Ripley Hesitates.
Yeah.
So Gorman gives the all clear that they're okay to go in. So the APC pulls up to the front door of the colonist pod, and everyone gets out to go in, and Ripley gets out, and she walks up to the door, and she stops. And you can see she kind of doesn't want to go in, and Hicks sees that she's hesitating, and he turns to her, he's like, are you okay? And she responds, no, I'm fine. And then she finally walks in the door, and the door is closed. And then it cuts to the scene where you see Gorman, like, literally going through the debris to see what's going on.
Correct.
Would you cut it or keep it?
I'd keep, actually. I really like this moment. I find it effective in the way that she did not want to come down to the planet initially. She didn't feel she needed to be a part of the mission. Granted, she may be thinking it's therapeutic. She's been having the nightmares or whatever. She's got to face her fears or whatever. But here's the moment. Now she's there. And this is it. She's going in again. This is happening again. And she's standing in the rain. I love the fact that it's raining. And she stops, even though it's raining. She's getting poured on. And she's literally, figuratively soaking it in. This is it. There's no turning back now. I'm going in. I find it effective. And it actually, in a little way, established, you know how I talked about I was a little bit disoriented by place where everything was. This helped establish it a little bit, because in the theatrical release, when you just mentioned how Gorman walks underneath and goes in through that barricaded area, I'm like, that's not the same place that they went in initially. And like, oh, because that was the north lock. This is the south lock. And they're entering through this. And it's a little bit more well-established as to where they are in the complex, I guess. I don't know. I keep it. It's not a very long scene. I like it.
Well, Jason, I'm disagreeing. I would cut it. But I do like the fact that it does kind of establish more of where they are. Keeping that scene definitely keeps a continuity error, because, I mean, Ripley is basically soaked when she's standing there waiting to go in. And then when she comes in, she's
for sure
dry. I mean, her hair is like matted to her head at that point. That's how far she's out there in that rain. And then she comes in, and I think it's a little jarring. I think we kind of understand she doesn't want to be there.
I think there was another deleted scene that they forgot to put in, though, where Hicks gives her a blow dryer before she goes in.
Oh, okay. Or yeah. Maybe it's got those doors that open up and then the wind blows.
It's a decompression kind of thing, or a decontamination kind of situation with the, That's actually what I was going to say initially. Yeah. You're right.
Gotcha.
You're
right. All right.
We'll agree to disagree.
Yeah. Again, wait till you hear the totals when we get to the end here. All right. So our next scene is a bunch of scenes, but we're going to put them all together. It's the robot sentries.
Yeah.
So you come to find out, after they get their butts kicked, the APC comes storming out of the atmosphere room, and they ask for the pickup from the dropship, and there's an alien in the dropship. So the ship now explodes, and they have to recover all the weapons that they have left, take stock of everything they have left.
Right.
So when they do that initial scene, as Hicks mentions, you know, we have this flamethrower, but he says, but luckily we have these robot sentries.
Right. Still intact.
Still intact. And there's four of them.
These are gun sentries. These are automatic guns that you can set up on mounts, like on tripods, that are basically robots that you can operate remotely. They're machine guns that you can set up in remote, just to further explain to the listeners what the robot sentry guns are.
Yeah. So the first mention is literally like two lines in the beginning. Additional weapons that they have to use against the aliens,
right.
Attack them in the command center. So then you jump ahead a little bit to where Hudson brings up the blueprints, and they're all sitting around and figuring out, like, okay, how are the aliens going to come in? Are they coming maybe through this corridor? And they maybe been coming in through this corridor. So we're going to seal this off, and they decide, all right, this is where we're going to put the sentry guns to keep us protected. We're going to put two on this side and two on this side, and then we'll seal it up. And this should keep us safe for a while until they somehow maybe find another spot in. So that's where the scene ends. So it's just an additional two or three lines. And Hicks is like, oh, that sounds like a great plan. Let's do it. So then we jump a little bit further in where they're making the barricades. They've set up the guns. And so there's like a little like remote control, like PCs that tie into the guns so they can work them remotely.
Right.
And they almost have like safety and arm setting. So they set them up. Hudson radios are Hicks. We're ready to go. Hicks is like, all right, let's do a quick test. He arms the one set that Vasquez and Hudson are with. And they just take a little pail or whatever and throw it in front of the guns. Bang, 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 bang. Guns go off. So you see how they work.
Right. They're motion sensitive. So these automatic weapons that are robot sentry guns, they track movement. Automatically just fire in the direction of anything moving.
And each of these guns have 500 rounds of ammunition.
Big guns.
Yes, big, big guns. So we cut ahead a little bit. Then all of a sudden we hear the alarm. So the aliens are deciding to do their first attack in one of the corridors. This seems a little bit quick. So basically you just hear everything. You hear the guns and you're just basically watching the computer monitor. Just the bullets just run down from 500 down to zero.
You faintly hear the alien screams.
Yes. So you don't really see anything.
They don't show you anything. Yeah.
The first attack. You're just hearing everything. And then both of the guns run out. And then which I thought was pretty cool, is like you actually hear the aliens like thumping on the barrier, trying to get in at that point. And they're like, oh, man, we might be in trouble. But then it cuts away. I can't remember how that scene cuts out. But they don't get in. They eventually just kind of give up. Because between the guns and the barrier itself, they're like, all right, we're not getting in this way. So then we jump into the last time we see the robot sentries is the alien second attack. So they come down the other corridor.
Right.
And this time you get to see the guns in action and you get to see them decimate the shit out of the aliens, which is cool. Like you literally just see them like pop, 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 pop.
Right.
Going up, acid going everywhere. And once again, it's cutting back to watching the bullets number go down. One of the guns completely runs out. At this point, like, we're in deep shit because they know this is probably the only other way in. And then the other gun gets to, I think, less than 10.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And it stops and the aliens retreat because they're just like, hey, we ain't going through this again.
Right.
So it scares them off enough that it's bought them more time, that the aliens need to find another way into the command center.
Got it.
So like I said, it's broken into one, two, three, yeah, like five different parts with these sentry guns. I love the sentry guns. I wish they kept this.
Really? Yeah. I gotcha. They're cool.
This is a keeper for me.
Absolutely.
It's kind of cool because it kind of shows a little bit of the intelligence or like the hive mentality of the alien.
I would agree with that. Yeah. As much as I like it, because I'm so partial, because the kid in me loves it. Mm-hmm. I love the weapons. I love the tech. The fact that they're basically these motion detector guns that can be just operated remotely. I like the sound design that initially you're just watching the counters drop, the ammo counters go down, and you hear the alien screams or squeals, and that's it. And it's just the tension from the POV of Ripley and Hicks and Hudson and Vasquez as they have to sit there and hope that the ammo doesn't run out before the aliens do. Yeah, so it's a tension build. But then I was like, we already get to see that effective tool, that device of watching the ammo counter run down. We see that on the side of the pulse rifles. That's kind of a device that's used already. And I didn't know how much these scenes really moved the story forward. But you're right, it is effective in the way that it does show that the aliens have this intelligence. Then kind of feeds the scene that comes up later when the motion trackers start going off and they're like, how did they get in? Because they found another, they had to find another way.
Right.
The aliens had no other choice. They had given up on every other. So they go through the ceiling. So it kind of feeds into that scene later. So yeah, I just didn't know. I understand why they cut it. Just, it felt like they were just trimming the fat, that this kind of, there's a repetitiveness to it, but there's also just a certain coolness to it. Again, with just the tech, there is kind of an artistic approach to it, actually, with not actually showing the second time you see the aliens exploding and getting blown up by the, which is pretty cool. It's pretty intense because, you know, once those guns run out of ammo, they're screwed. But as it turns out, they get lucky.
Right.
The aliens decide to take another route. So they retreat. Right, I don't know, man. This is a tough one, man. I wasn't sold at first. I was like, yeah, this is cool. But I don't know. It does move the story forward in a couple ways that I really wasn't too keen on before. I don't know. I'll say, let's keep it. It's pretty cool.
We're keeping it. All right. So moving ahead. So there's an extended scene between Newt and Ripley when Ripley puts Newt to sleep in the med lab. Newt basically asks Ripley if she thinks her mom got impregnated by one of the facehuggers. And, you know, Ripley doesn't want to answer it. And then Newt kind of follows it up with, well, isn't that where babies come from? And
right.
Ripley's like, yeah. And then Newt asks Ripley if she's had a kid. To which Ripley replies, yes. And then Newt's like, what happened to her? And
Ripley says she's gone.
Right. So, and then Newt gives so that means she's dead.
Right.
And then it continues with what we've seen before.
Right.
Brief. It's maybe like 10 additional lines. Since I'm keeping the opening scene with the daughter, I got to keep this one too. Cause it just ties. Yeah, I think it just ties the two in. So I'm keeping it.
Yeah, you know, there's a point to be made for that. I see what you're saying. I'm cutting it.
Okay.
Because you and I and Marwan will talk about this a lot as writers, screenwriters. It's the show, don't tell. I'm still not completely sold as to how important it is or what does it mean for this movie. I think it has a different effectiveness for different people. For me, I don't know where I land on this. So this particular conversation, it's hard, it's sensitive, it's bittersweet, but I think because we do have that original scene, we understand the pain, the loss that Ripley feels, the loss of a daughter. We understand from Newt's perspective, the loss of parents, and they need each other. They're kind of filling a void for each other. But I think things have been established to this point, and their connection has been shown through the actions. It's been shown to us. It hasn't been told to us. That's becoming understood through their experiences together. And I think without this conversation and the way it is in the theatrical release, where she's just simply tucking Newt in to have a nap, and Newt asks about, he says, you know, my mom used to tell the kids, myself and my brother, there were no monsters, but that's not true, is it? And it's a little bit of a kind of this honest conversation between the two of them. There's still a bond that's forming there that proves the point, that it gets the point across that they're connecting. I think this additional bit doesn't, there's a kind of a still like a coldness to it. The writing is a little bit off for me personally. That's just my take on it. I don't think it's necessary.
No. Okay. No, I definitely see what you're saying. I could go either way on it, but yeah, I want to keep it.
Yeah.
All right. So two more. They're both really quick. So the next one is discussion in the med lab. It's basically right. When Bishop gives a report about what he's found out about the facehuggers, and Ripley's just like, this, how does this really help us? And then they kind of talk into the hive mentality. And this is the first time they actually bring up a mention of, well, there's all these eggs. What's laying the eggs? And Bishop says, it must be something we haven't seen before, possibly a queen. So he literally says the word queen.
Right.
And
yeah, Hudson's saying, oh, it's like ants in Vasquez. No, it's bees. It's beehive, not ant hive.
Yes.
And it's, yeah, just supposed to be some funny banter.
Yeah. So I would cut that because
agreed.
The fact that they said queen.
Two on the nose.
It blows the surprise. So yeah. We are in agreement on that one.
Absolutely.
Okay. And then the last one, I for some reason, I think we'll be in agreement on this one too. So this is the end of the movie. They meet up with Bishop, and Ripley says, we got to go back to get Newt. And she gets all her gear. She's ready to leave. And her and Hicks has this quick moment where they tell each other their first name. So we find out Hicks's first name is Dwayne. And we find out, well, we already know it's Ellen Ripley, but Ripley tells Hicks what her name is, and then she walks off. So it's just a really brief exchange of the two of them, two additional lines. Cut it.
Absolutely, 100%. It doesn't work. It's cheesy. It's supposed to be a slightly romantic moment. There's a scene previous to this where Hicks and Ripley get a little bit close at times. There's no real intimacy, definitely no physical intimacy, but we see a connection between them where Hicks is trying to help her and take care of her, even though she's quite independent. He gives her the locator wristwatch, makes the joke like, you know, this doesn't mean we're engaged or anything kind of thing. You see, there's a little flirtation, right? Little flirtation. So at this moment at the end, she looks back at him and says, you're going to be all right, or something to that effect. And Hicks, and he says, it's Dwayne Hicks. She's like, I'm Ellen. And he says, well, don't be gone long, Ellen. Ooh. And I'm like, hey guys, we got a ticking clock issue here. We don't have time for this romantic bullshit. You got to go rescue a little Newt. Remember? So it just doesn't work at all for me. I agree. Cut it.
So here's our final scores here. So of the 11 additional scenes for the special edition, Jason, you had 4 keeps and 7 cuts. I also had 4 keeps and 7 cuts.
Ha ha.
And we actually agreed on 7 of them.
All right.
So not too bad. Better than I
thought. So what this proves is we can still be friends.
Yes, for at least another episode of the show. We'll see what happens right. Next week.
Yeah. Over or under? Bill and Jason's friendship exactly. Lasts 2 more episodes.
Yeah. All right. So that is the special edition of Aliens. So, so we're moving on to the end here.
Yeah. I had a quick couple comments. Now, you know, if you were the director, is there anything you would add or cut yourself with the way it is? Let's just say maybe the theatrical version. I'm going to put a couple things out there. When Ripley goes after Burke initially and says, I know you were the one that told the colonists to go look at the ship, and you set this whole thing up. You're a son of a bitch, and I'm going to tell them what you did. I'm going to nail you right to the wall. Very intense sequence. I was like, she tells him that she looked through the colony log and had figured out that he had alerted them to the fact that they need to go investigate the ship that has the freaking aliens on it. So he set the whole thing up from the beginning. I would have kind of liked that scene where she maybe by herself goes in the operation center, kind of has a moment aside and is going through the colony log to try to put together the pieces. Like, how did this happen? Because they're trying to figure it out. And to kind of just, it could be a brief scene where she comes across this information that Burke is kind of the mastermind behind this. Just a small scene. It's just a thought I thought could have been a dramatic scene that kind of been cool. I like that when you see this a lot in crime dramas where the detective comes upon a piece of information, is going through the case files, comes across a photo, a piece of evidence or something that ties things together. They're kind of by themselves and they're, again, just trying to put the clues together. And they come across that one piece of information. It's an aha moment where I would have liked to seen Ripley going through the colony log going, oh, shit, it's Burke. Burke is manipulating this. He's been manipulating it before we even got here, that son of a bitch. And I had another thought is at the very end, was there ever a thought of hinting at another sequel? I would have put in a scene, maybe, I don't know what they would have done specifically. It's just food for thought. Like, I would have liked a slightly more haunting ending, maybe. You know, we get them peacefully falling asleep and the music is slightly eerie at the end, but maybe a little hint at something dark is still lurking in the corner. I don't know. Just put it out there. I don't know if you had any thoughts about either cuts or additions you would have made if you were James Cameron.
I think I would have liked another of the Marines to survive that initial onslaught and then somehow have that Marine die in between then and the final battle.
Uh-huh.
There's too few of them at the end. So maybe
gotcha.
One of them, another one of them comes back and they're doing patrol or something like that. And the first time they realize like an alien somehow snags that person somehow.
I gotcha. Sure.
I don't know.
Good thought.
That's my initial thought.
I gotcha. All right. I like it. Well, we can move on, man.
Save Wurzbowski.
Yeah.
So I know who he is.
Where's
when he Wurzbowski?
No, it's Wurzbowski. No, you're not saying it right. You're confusing everybody, Hicks.
I can't believe that. Okay, so that brings us up to final thoughts on Aliens. Jason, you have any final thoughts on Aliens?
Yeah, I have one main one, and that's going to apply directly to the man, Bill Paxton. Do yourself a favor, go on YouTube, watch the supercut of all of Hudson's lines. It's great. This movie really propelled his career. RIP Bill Paxton. Love that guy, man. Yes. Loved him in everything he was in. Some of my favorite Bill Paxton films, The Terminator, Weird Science, obviously Aliens, Navy SEALs, Predator 2, One False Move, that one's for Marwan,
yes.
Trespass, Indian Summer, Tombstone, Apollo 13, Twister, Titanic, A Simple Plan, Frailty, Edge of Tomorrow. I never watched the show Big Love, but heard a lot of good things about it. That's a critically acclaimed show. My favorite role of his, of all of the films, is True Lies. I think he is hilarious in it. He's got a more of a supporting role. I just think he's brilliant in it. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that back in 86, he was indeed in an episode of Miami Vice as Vic Romano in the episode entitled Streetwise. Bill Paxton, just gone too soon. Rest in peace.
Rest in peace, Bill. That was a tough one to hear when he passed away.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Oh, here, this is going to be my other one. The Xenomorph life cycle.
Oh, there we go.
This was interesting because you and I, we've talked about this a bit. It goes from ovomorph, that's the actual egg, to facehugger, to chestburster, to then the Xenomorph, the full-grown alien as we know it. The question you and I had is also, what does an alien do with the dead body? What do they do with the dead bodies? We know they cocoon the live ones to be hosts for the chestbursters. What do they do with the dead? So a little bit of research tells me the drone aliens can theoretically cocoon and use the dead bodies for food. This is gross and disgusting, but amazing for food. Or actually, they can have the dead bodies cocooned and they mutate into eggs themselves, the actual eggs or ovomorphs. The mutation process is called egg morphing, and it actually is seen in the director's cut of Alien, the first film. There is a deleted scene was put in the director's cut with Captain Dallas and Brett, that other character, I believe that's Harry Dean Stanton, being mutated. They're actually mutating into eggs, theorizing that an actual soul alien, like a drone alien, could keep the species alive, even if it were isolated, like if it was by itself and cocooned a dead person, that body would mutate into an actual egg. Then that would give birth to the face hugger, then would impregnate another person, and the cycle continues. The queen, we talked about this, like how do they procreate? And apparently the queen uses its ovipositor to lay the ovomorphs, the eggs. We see this at the end of Aliens, but apparently it doesn't need drones to fertilize her. So I'm just saying that apparently it's all immaculate conception.
There you go.
So a little bit of stuff.
As Jeff Goldblum would say, life finds a way.
Yes, exactly. So I have a couple of questions for you, but then that's all I got. What, you got some other deep final thoughts?
Oh, just one quick thing, because I know we mentioned this in the first episode about Burke, where we assumed he gets killed by the alien when he goes into the med lab.
Yes.
Supposedly, when they released the Blu-ray version, they showed a scene where Ripley actually runs across Burke cocooned when she goes to St. Newt, and he complained that he's already been impregnated and he feels the alien in him, and Ripley gives him a grenade and runs off. I'm certainly glad they didn't put that in, because the scene, I actually watched the scene yesterday. It's not good.
Yeah.
Paul Reiser's performance actually is not good in it, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they didn't release that until the Blu-ray. So I was just like everyone else, just assuming he got killed at that point, but no, he got cocooned. And then I guess there's a video game out called Alien Marines, where they actually go back to LV-426 and they actually find Hudson's body cocooned. And his chest is burst open. So, yeah, he does
again.
Yeah, I know. That kind of sucks.
Son of a bitch. Tonya, man, I should have gone back for Hudson.
But, yeah, there's just, like, we literally could do a whole year on this movie. I think we've done more than enough with these two shows. And, like I said, it's one of my favorite films in the 80s. You know, when you talk about sequels, this is definitely one of the best out there, too.
Probably top five best sequels of all time.
Yes. I would agree with that.
It's up there.
So you got questions?
I did. Yeah, okay. So this is tough, man. Alien or aliens?
I go aliens, but it's one of those, if you're alien, I can't argue with you.
Yeah.
I get it. But I think some of it maybe has to do with the fact that I saw Aliens first. So that's...
It's hard, right? It's hard. Yeah. I think it depends on the day. It just depends on the day. You'd have to, and I'd probably go back and forth, because I, in my heart of hearts, I think I might go with Alien, actually, because it's the first. I like it being just one that they're going after. But man,
you win either way. That's the way I.
You really do, and this sequel is just, it's so good. It's so solid all around, despite all the freaking issues we came.
Yeah, exactly.
So here's the question. Ridley Scott versus James Cameron, man. I was just going to ask you, man, not in a fight, but who do you got? Director versus director, or whose filmography do you prefer? Ridley Scott. We've got Alien, Blade Runner, Someone Watch Over Me, Black Rain, White Squall, G.I. Jane, Thelma Louise, Gladiator, Hannibal, Black Hawk Down, Matchstick Men, Body of Lies, The Martian. James Cameron, Terminator, Aliens, The Abyss, T2 Judgment Day, True Lies, Titanic. 12 years go by. And then Avatar.
You didn't put Piranha 2. Come on. That's the one.
I skipped a bunch of Ridley Scott ones too that were not my favorites. It's a taste thing. Don't beat me up for it.
Oh, man. It's tough because you have like such a big body of work versus a small body of work. But everything that Cameron's come out with is basically been gold.
Mm-hmm.
Because actually one of my favorites is the one movie that most people don't talk about is The Abyss. I love The Abyss.
Yeah.
Especially the director's cut. That's definitely one of my favorites.
I agree. I love The Abyss. That's
With Ridley Scott. Yeah. I would have to write down, like, if I took out James Cameron's film and then put him up against Ridley Scott's top films,
mm-hmm.
just to see where that goes. But I would have to go with Cameron.
I'm a Ridley Scott guy.
We'll see what happens with the new Avatar movies, but
it's tough. I mean, they're so, like, if you just took the best against the best, it's almost even as far, because they both made films that have changed the industry. They're game changers.
You just say Blade Runner, Alien.
That's it. And for Cameron, you got, Terminator, Aliens, T2. See, I'm not a Titanic guy. I understand. You can make an argument. And I'm not an Avatar guy either. But you can't deny the effect, the immense effect they've had on the industry.
Yeah.
As artists. So.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
That's all I got, man. If that weren't enough.
So we're actually wrapping it up. All right.
Oh, wait. I'm kidding.
All right. So that wraps it up for part two of our special two-part Aliens episode. Thank you for listening. We will be back next week to discuss the Cold War teen drama War Games, starring Matthew Broderick and Ally Sheedy. As always, please subscribe and rate us. You can email us at allindiesmoviespodcast@gmail.com. Please send us your feedback, questions, or recipes to share. You can follow us on Facebook at All 80s Movies Podcast or tweet us at Podcast All 80s. Until then, have a totally great week, everyone.
Thanks for staying up with us. Good night, world.